real sadness of realizing that something that has been an important part of Southeast for years and years and years is probably going away.
The popular fast ferry service is likely finished in Southeast. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the search continues for a missing 10-year-old Kotzebue girl.
We've had folks from all across the community and the region volunteer to assist yesterday. We had at least 50 people.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Alaska's Fast Ferry completed what's likely to be its last Southeast run this past weekend. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, there's been some sadness over the loss of a popular service.
When the MV Fairweather entered service in 2004, there was excitement over a catamaran capable of doing 32 knots. That allowed it to run from Juneau to other Southeast ports in about half the time it takes the rest of the fleet.
Welcome aboard Alaska's Marine Highway and the new Fairweather class of ferries.
During the ferry's run from Skagway and Haines to Juneau on September 9th, the Fairweather's crew made an announcement. One of the passengers on board was 34-year-old Carl Broderson of Juneau. He set the scene.
There's two sort of stone-faced looking officers standing on either side of a cake that says Bon Voyage Fairweather, and you ask them what's going on, and they explain that this is almost assuredly the last voyage the Fairweather is going to take in Southeast.
Frosted cake was shared between passengers and crew. Broderson said there was
a moment of real sadness at realizing that something that has been an important part of Southeast for years and years and years is probably going away.
There were originally two fast ferries, but the Fairweather's sister ship, the MV Chiniga, has been tied up since 2015, when the state said it couldn't afford to run it. Officially, at least, the fate of the sole remaining fast ferry remains undecided. General Manager John Falvey says two Alaska-class vessels are expected to enter service next year, putting the future of the Fairweather in doubt.
Basically, we can't keep the same ships running when you got two new ones coming in. So we're in the process of making those decisions, and we've not made those decisions yet.
The slower Alaska-class vessels have more passenger and vehicle capacity. They're also touted to be more fuel-efficient and hence less expensive to run than the fast ferries, and more seaworthy in harsh winter weather. When the first Alaska-class is delivered next year, that's when Falvey says it's decision time.
We will need to take a very close look at what is the best fleet mix as far as service, as far as budgets and funding to go forward from May 1, and that decision has not been made yet.
The legislature has cut ferry funding by about $29 million over the past 5 years. That's led to inevitable cuts to service.
Well, I think there's a general concern, really, what the long-term viability is for service, especially to some of our smaller communities, as we see more and more of the fleet aging and being retired.
Robert Venables chairs Alaska's Marine Transportation Advisory Board.
You know, we're seeing a swap out of vessels with the Alaska-class ferry, but at the same time, we're not quite sure exactly how that's going to be scheduled or deployed. So that does leave a lot of potential riders wondering how that's going to work out.
Southeast residents like Carl Broderson and Juneau say service cuts are making it harder to use the ferry on a regular basis.
You used to be sure there was always going to be a good, convenient ferry for when you wanted to make a trip, and we simply don't have that anymore.
That leads to what he describes as a death spiral.
Because the schedules are not good because they don't have enough passengers because people can't take the ferry because the schedule isn't good.
For now, the Fairweather remains on the job, but in Prince William Sound, not in Southeast. As it did last winter, the ship will connect the communities of Cordova, Whittier, and Valdez. At least until May, when its role in the fleet will be decided. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The FBI has joined the effort to find a missing girl in Kotzebue. 10-year-old Ashley Johnson Barr was last seen the evening of September 6th, leaving a local park. Kotzebue police, Alaska State Troopers, the Coast Guard, and numerous others have been looking for her since. The effort is being led by a state incident management team. Alaska State Troopers spokesperson Jonathan Taylor says the troopers sought help from the FBI for additional staffing and expertise.
Rescue operation, a key part of that is looking into the circumstances surrounding the disappearance of the individual who is missing, and so we requested assistance from them.
Johnson Barr's cell phone was found on a street after her disappearance, and Taylor says it's being analyzed.
Ashley's cell phone was found about a half mile away from where she was last seen at Rainbow Park. And that is with investigators now. They're analyzing it, trying to determine if it's been damaged, if there's any information that they can glean from that.
Kotzebue is a compact community surrounded by a lot of water and open tundra. And Taylor says the search is multifaceted.
Canvassing the area on land, by ATV, by air.
He says daily sweeps of the community are being conducted by professionals and numerous volunteers from Kotzebue and other communities.
We've had folks from all across the community and the region volunteer to assist yesterday. We had at least 50 people. We were, I believe, expecting at least that many today to help with the canvassing and search efforts.
Taylor emphasizes that the focus remains on finding Ashley Johnson Barr safe and getting her home to family. The state is fining the main group opposing the Salmon Habitat Ballot Initiative nearly $2,000. The Alaska Public Offices Commission says the group violated a rule that requires an organization fighting an initiative to clearly state its opposition in its name. The organization is now called Stand for Alaska, Vote No on One. But the group was called simply Stand for Alaska until June 12th, when it changed its name. The group also used Stand for Alaska in several campaign videos posted online. Stand for Salmon, a group campaigning for the initiative, filed the complaint with the commission. It argues the name Stand for Alaska was intentionally confusing voters. A Stand for Alaska Vote No on One spokesperson says the organization made an honest mistake and plans on paying the fine. The National Park Service has again extended the public comment period on a proposed sport hunting and trapping regulatory change. The controversial change proposed for Alaska National Preserve lands would allow state-permitted practices like bear baiting, using artificial light to kill bears at den sites, killing coyotes during denning season, and killing of swimming caribou. The techniques were banned by the agency in 2015 and then proposed for reinstatement by the Trump administration. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The regulatory change was initially put out for public feedback in May. The National Park Service extended it in July and last week stretched the comment deadline again, this time to November 5th. Park Service spokesman Pete Christian says the extensions were all in response to public requests.
Simultaneous with that, we released the environmental assessment for the proposed rule, and the comment period for both of those is running simultaneously.
Christian says the environmental assessment looked at the effects of the regulatory change and found no broad-scale impacts to wildlife populations.
So on the ground, in an individual National Preserve unit or in a local area, there may be some changes to patterns and or movement of wildlife or population itself locally. But overall, over the whole state of Alaska, there wouldn't be an effect.
Christian says the proposed change has drawn abundant public feedback.
We are getting, I would say, unprecedented amount of public comment on this anytime in the recent past, over 120,000 comments. And of that, 25,000 are substantive and unique comments of their own. So comments that challenge the accuracy of the NEPA document itself or the adequacy of the environmental analysis. Quite a bit of interest in this from the public.
Christian says comments received so far have not been formally evaluated, but it appears that a large majority strongly oppose changing the 2015 regulation. He says once the public comment period closes in November, the Park Service regional director will either sign a statement of no significant impact or order development of a full environmental impact statement, a process that could potentially stretch until the 2020 presidential election. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska says it settled a lawsuit with the city of Palmer that alleged officers wrongfully detained a Peruvian man over his immigration status. The ACLU says that in exchange for dropping his lawsuit, Alex Caseda received $50,000 in compensation, a written apology from the city, and changes to police procedures in handling immigration detainers and warrants. Caseda was helping provide security at a bar in Palmer in August 2017 when a fight erupted. He tried to help a female bartender and was hit and left bloodied. The lawsuit says a responding officer asked Caseda if he was from Alaska before asking a dispatcher to contact federal immigration officials. Caseda is married to a U.S. citizen but lacked legal immigration status. City officials did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau man allegedly assaults his grandmother while in court for assault.
My grandson jumped from right here beside his attorney and knocked me out.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
The Army Corps of Engineers has awarded a $14.8 million contract to a Palmer-based contractor for work on a missile defense-related project at Clear Air Force Station near Anderson. The contract awarded to White Mountain Construction calls for construction of a secure facility for the radar site at Clear. The project is one of several going through the $345 million project, which is intended to improve the military's ability to detect and intercept incoming enemy missiles. Jomo Stewart with the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation says the radar facility is one of many military construction projects underway at Clear, Eielson Air Force Base, and the Missile Defense Base at Fort Greely.
There are a number of military and defense-related projects going on throughout the interior, so a substantial dollar figure and a substantial amount of work.
According to Fedco, a total of some $1.5 billion in military construction work was scheduled through this year for the interior. Stewart says that's bringing more jobs to the interior.
We, as much as possible, want to make sure that as much of that work is conducted by local contractors, either directly or as subcontractors.
The entry control facility project at Clear is scheduled to be completed in September of 2020. The University of Alaska Fairbanks-operated research vessel Sikuliak is proving to be a good investment. That's according to UAF College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences Dean Bradley Moran during an update to University Regents last week.
The state of Alaska provides $500,000 a year as an investment that turns back roughly $12 million in revenue.
UAF operates the Sikuliak for the National Science Foundation, which funds research projects, and Moran says much of the NSF-funded work is conducted by University of Alaska researchers.
And in fiscal year 18, believe it or not, 74% of the time at sea doing science, it was someone from the university on that vessel. That's an amazing statistic. We were shooting for 20% in our strategic plan.
Moran says that will help the university when it has to compete to retain the NSF operation contract in 2023. Moran says the university is also investing in up to 5 new faculty who will work aboard the Sikuliak. Noting challenges facing the Sikuliak program, Moran listed the need for a new $10 to $12 million pier facility at Seward, but he says he does not think resecuring the NSF operating contract in 2023 is contingent on building a new pier. The state has filed charges against two Unalaska teenagers who allegedly threatened another teen with a handgun this July. That's likely all the information Unalaskans will get about the case unless it moves to the adult court system. As KUCB's Laura Craigle reports, the rest of the details remain confidential under Alaska law.
Officials say they can't release the names of the minors or the charges against them, citing confidentiality policies that govern the State Division of Juvenile Justice.
It can be a mystifying black box for the public.
Matt Davidson works at the division's headquarters in Juneau, and he says communities often want more information when it comes to kids and public safety. While that's understandable, he says, Alaska law protects the privacy of juvenile delinquency records for a reason.
Children who commit criminal acts should have an opportunity to repair the harm they've done without a criminal conviction being on their permanent public record. And so keeping them privileged, that protects the youth from having something that they did as a 12-year-old, for example, follow them throughout their whole life.
With that mission in mind, Davidson says most cases result in probation. Judges work with families, schools, and social service providers to create plans aimed at addressing the needs of young offenders and preventing future crimes.
Generally, there aren't a lot of jury trials, but they can happen.
Trials are reserved for serious offenses. In some cases, kids can end up in juvenile detention until they're 19. Even more rarely, Davidson says some offenders are tried as adults, usually if they commit serious crimes past the age of 16.
And those are crimes like murder, first-degree assault, and arson in the first degree.
He says cases moved to the adult system do become public. For now, it's unclear where the Unalaska case fits on the spectrum of offenses and how long it'll take to move through the juvenile justice process. Acting Police Chief Jennifer Shockley described the incident as disturbing, but says the accused teenagers are currently out of custody on unspecified conditions of release. School officials previously announced that the teens had been placed on homebound instruction and were completing schoolwork from home, but Superintendent John Conwell says he can't comment further because student records are private under federal law. He says the earlier information was only released as an emergency exception to alleviate community fears of a threat against the school. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
A 26-year-old Juneau man spent roughly 6 months in jail for allegedly assaulting his grandmother. Then the man, who's diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, did it again, this time in a Juneau courtroom. And it took 11 minutes for a law enforcement officer to arrive in that courtroom. As Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports, the incident is raising questions about courthouse security.
On August 6th, Connie Chitty was testifying in a closed guardianship hearing for her grandson Tyler Letham on the third floor of the Diamond Courthouse. The hearing would help determine if the state would become the guardian for Letham. Chitty told a recent forum held by supporters of candidate for Governor Mike Dunleavy what happened next. She says she was testifying about the earlier assault.
While I was standing just like this, speaking directly to the judge, my eyes not wavering, my grandson jumped from right here beside his attorney and knocked me out in one punch.
While Letham stopped the assault after his mother and others in the courtroom urged him to stop, it took time for help to arrive.
There's only two of us in this, besides his attorney, the judge, his secretary, both pushing a panic button inside a locked room, and no one came.
The courthouse had two judicial services officers who would have been responsible for responding, but both were guarding prisoners at the time. A Juneau police officer outside of the courthouse responded and arrived 11 minutes after the alarm. For Chitty, the incident raises two concerns. One is about courthouse security. The other is about whether the state provides enough mental health treatment to those like Letham who need it. Chitty says the statewide need for inpatient mental health treatment far exceeds the capacity of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute.
He does not particularly need prison, but a mental health institution.
Chitty had this concern before the August incident. After Letham's first alleged assault against her in February, he was first jailed, then flown to Anchorage. His family understood that the state was seeking to move him to the State Psychiatric Institute. However, Chitty says that never happened, and he spent much of his time in solitary confinement.
I don't know if we're going to get help for our Tyler.
Neil Nisham is the area court administrator for Southeast Alaska. He was working nearby when the incident occurred. He says officers are generally in courtrooms at the request of one of the parties or the judge.
If somebody would be considered dangerous and a threat in the courtroom, certainly either party or either attorney could ask the court to provide some sort of JS officer or JPD officer or state trooper to be present if that were the case. To my knowledge, we haven't received anything along those lines.
Nisham says those who work in the courthouse learned from the August incident.
It was an unusual incident. I don't think anybody really expected that to happen. Certainly it's one of those things where it went for the learning books in terms of what to look out for in terms of does someone have any mental health issues and would they be considered a danger to society or those people in the courtroom.
Nisham says the incident may lead to having more security in the courthouse.
I would expect that the change would primarily result with the additional staff of judicial service officers. Right now, they only have two. Typically, in the past, they've had three. I don't know if that's because of budget cuts or if there's just the inability of being able to find somebody. But simply the presence of another judicial service officer would certainly help.
Chitty flew down to Seattle last week to have her injuries from the incident checked out.
It's been horrible for our family, but we are moving forward.
Letham has been in Juneau's Lemon Creek Correctional Center since the incident, and Chitty says the state has been granted guardianship over him. That means the state will provide for his treatment and everyday living needs. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Alaska has the second highest rate of suicide in the nation. That's according to a 2016 study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Yesterday marked World Suicide Prevention Day, and KSTK's June Leffler listened to a survivor story. She has this report.
Darian Gerald was just a freshman in Wrangell when she developed an eating disorder.
When I was going through that, it actually brought me down lower, and I got down really low into a really dark place.
Gerald was of the 1% of Americans every year who have made a plan to kill themselves, according to CDC stats.
When I finally got to the point where I was going to take my life, the day I was actually going to do it, I asked for help.
She went to the local medical health clinic, receiving therapy and medications. And to this day, she still goes to counseling, taking that extra time and effort to keep herself healthy. Gerald hopes that sharing her story can help high schoolers and those at any age seek help.
We didn't have someone speak when I was in high school, and I know that if I was sitting there as a freshman and hearing someone basically describe what I was going through, I knew that that would have sparked me to get help sooner.
CDC stats say suicide is the second leading cause of death for those aged 10 to 24. In Alaska, a third of all high schoolers have felt hopeless consistently for 2 weeks or more, and a fifth of students have suicide plans. That's according to an Alaska Department of Public Health survey released last year. If you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, you can contact your local mental health provider or call the National Suicide Prevention Line at 1-800-273-8255. In Wrangell, I'm June Leffler.
Sitka resident Jerry Dugan was a college student in Chicago in 1968 and witnessed firsthand the riots in the streets during the Democratic National Convention in late August. A bystander, he was nevertheless beaten and arrested during widespread efforts by Chicago police to clear the streets and restore order. As KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports, Dugan is now 70 years old and thinks it's important to share the powerful lesson he learned that day.
So what did not happen in 1968? It was the year Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were assassinated, the year of the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, and the year that rioters took to the streets surrounding the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. It was an unprecedented level of political violence in an already violent year. Jerry Dugan was a 20-year-old college student, a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War. He and three or four friends decided to head into Old Town on the northwest side of Chicago to see what was going on.
I had avoided most of the protests because I wasn't into damaging property and breaking windows or throwing bricks at people or calling policemen names or anything like that or overturning cars. That was a big one, police cars, of some of my peers. So I wanted to go to but I wanted to see what was happening. It had already been going on for a day or two. It was on the media. And I just wanted to go down one evening and see if I could find something peaceful going on.
So they drove into the city and parked. As he and his friends emerged from the car, they realized that they had stopped right in front of a police line.
But it had just formed behind us as we were parking the car. So there was police lined across the street from bar to store. Actually, I could look behind me and see them pulling people out of bars.
And this was these were guys with shields and
there was full dressed Chicago police, helmets, face guards, bulletproof vests, mace, service revolvers, truncheons.
Dugan says the next 15 minutes changed his life. Rioters were starting fires and barrels to try and block the police line. His group was trapped. Dugan says his best option was to escape on foot.
It was walking out of the car into a riot, basically, and it was out of control on both sides. It was so I saw a side street and immediately ran down it to get out of the main street. Like, I just wanted out of there. And as soon as I ran down the side street, I remember being by myself and seeing a uniformed police officer with all the riot gear come out of an alleyway and tell me to stop. So I stopped, and he ran over to me, and what I vividly remember was the hatred in his eyes. And this was a man not much older than me, maybe in his early 20s, and he was very angry about something. And I don't know what happened to him previously, but he told me to stop, and I thought, well, the safest thing to do is do what he says. So I stopped, and then he grabbed me, and he started beating me with his billy club. And the image I had of that was, this is what it's like to be in warfare. This is what it's like when you have the enemy in your grasp and in your eyes, and you want nothing more than to do damage.
Dugan says he grew up in a rough neighborhood, and this wasn't his first fight. He managed to twist out of the officer's grasp, and as he did so, he saw an empty police paddy wagon. He dashed into it and shut the doors. It was an ironic escape, but Dugan says it seemed like the safest place to be at the time. Eventually, the paddy wagon was loaded, and he and others were taken to jail overnight. A warrant for his arrest was issued after the fact, and when he appeared in court 2 months later, the judge threw out the case. Dugan witnessed more conflict and brutality during his night in a Chicago jail, but it didn't turn him against police. In fact, in his current career as a Marine safety trainer, he has nothing but respect for the first responders and law enforcement officers he works with. His experience instead taught him about the futility of violence.
I think I was already pretty radicalized. I think maybe the way it radicalized me in a different direction was the importance of nonviolence, stopping at the point of being physical and doing damage, which I already kind of had a pretty good ethos about, but it even more so. I saw what extreme emotions can do to people and how it can act them out in ways that they would not normally act out. That I know in their home lives, they're probably quite different, and in their own personal relationships with each other. And the need to take strong emotional feelings, which you all have, de-escalate them and give it time to think about and to heal and find other ways to act it out.
Dugan says one way some cultures measure time surrounding important events is by the lifespans of people left to remember them. In that respect, the Holocaust, he says, is coming to a close. In a couple of decades, 1968 will reach the same threshold, and although the memories of that turbulent year will fade, he hopes the lessons will not. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Jacob Resnick and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, June Leffler in Wrangell, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.